From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
We deserve and we very much need to have confidence in our vote, and that's exactly what we're calling for.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein on why she's pushing for a recount in three states. Plus, Congressman Stephen Lynch tells us why he's voting to oust Nancy Pelosi as House Minority Leader. Also today, could a soda tax be coming to Massachusetts?
Though I don't think it will totally solve the problem, I think it does at least help people think about what they're purchasing, perhaps more than they would otherwise.
And a new regional analysis shows the local economy is booming, but it's tied to a decline in affordable housing.
Many developers are saying, we know how to build for the rich. We even know how to build for the very poor with subsidies. We haven't quite figured out yet how to build for everybody else.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we will begin today with Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. She is pushing for recounts in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, three states where Donald Trump narrowly defeated Hillary Clinton. Stein filed a recount petition last week in Wisconsin. That state is moving forward with her request. She has until tomorrow to file a petition in Michigan, which her lawyer says she'll do. And in Pennsylvania just yesterday, Stein filed a recount lawsuit alleging that the election there was, quote, illegal. Stein has raised $6.3 million for the effort so far, vastly more than the $3.5 million she raised for her entire presidential campaign. And she joins us now in the studio. Dr. Stein, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. First of all, let me ask you, in the petition that you filed in Pennsylvania for a recount, your lawyer wrote in that petition that, quote, the petitioners have grave concerns about the integrity of electronic voting machines used in their districts. Do you have specific evidence for those concerns?
So, you know, the thing about voting machines is that you cannot find or see this evidence unless you actually look for it. And the only way you can look for it is by actually counting the votes. So if you look at the track record of these machines, for example, in 2004, that 90,000 votes were found, paper ballots that did not get counted because the optical scanner that counts them wasn't quite programmed correctly. Things were just a little bit askew. 90,000 votes were found only because a lawsuit was filed and they actually went back and counted them. Some of the machines that are used, for example, in Wisconsin have been outlawed in California because they have been shown to be readily tampered with. They've been prone to human error and so on. So this has been a longstanding movement, which really grew out of the recount in Ohio back in 2004. There's been a growing awareness that the equipment that we use, the technology we rely on, is extremely untrustworthy. Mm. And in this election, where there was lots of rampant mistrust and distrust all around, databases that were being tampered with and hacked into, we think it's very important that we be able to have confidence in our votes.
But mistrust is different than actual misdeed, though. I mean, I think we're living in a world where people have a grave amount of mistrust for many things related to our political system.
Exactly.
But there's an evidence gap, though.
Well, you know, the evidence...
Let me just jump in here, because I do want to... you mentioned Wisconsin specifically, and we actually spoke with the Wisconsin Election Commission today, Reed Magny. He's the public information officer there. And he said, this is a quote from him, the fact is that none of the equipment used in Wisconsin has been shown to have any problems. Every piece of equipment is subjected to a public test at least 10 days before the election to verify its accuracy, and that all of the equipment used in Wisconsin has been certified by the U.S. Elections Commission.
Yes, but as they've been deeply looked at by the state of California, now by Maryland and Virginia, which are also in the process of disqualifying these machines, you know, you need to have evidence in order to pursue wrongdoing on the part of people. We protect people, and we protect our civil rights and our civil liberties. So you need evidence. Excuse me. Sorry. You need evidence in order to pursue a question of wrongdoing. But in the case of our votes, it really should be the opposite. Mm. We should have automatic safeguards and reassurances built into our voting system. And that's really the larger point here, is that we should not be operating with machines that have been proven to be extremely fallible and subject to tampering and human error, that we deserve safeguards that are built in. We should have automatic audits that take place as a rule, and that we should have recounts when races are very close.
Well, I mean, a lot of states do have automatic recounts when races are very close. But about you mentioned, so you
and
mentioned
not in these three,
not in these three.
Yes.
But you mentioned voting machines in Michigan. They vote all on paper ballots. So what's your
paper ballots, which are counted by optical scanners, and the scanners have problems as well. That case I mentioned in Ohio of 90,000 votes that were discovered that did not get counted, that's by optical scanners. So what you want is to actually count the votes. You know, when you talk to everyday people about this, in my experience, what everyday people are very quick to say is, yeah, I don't trust this system. I would like to verify it. I would like to feel like I can be confident in the outcome. You know, I think that it's a system which is not only shielded from the light of day, so we don't actually see our votes. It's very hard to double check on these votes, and we have to raise millions of dollars in order to just get the reassurance that ought to be built into the system. It's not only raising millions of dollars, we also have to jump through incredible administrative hoops in order to make this happen. But this is a reassurance, especially in today's climate, that should just be automatic.
How does the mistrust that you're reflecting here differ from the mistrust that Donald Trump has reflected about the election?
You know, that's
for
a really good point, because I think we see mistrust across the political spectrum. We saw Donald Trump talk about a rigged election. We saw, and he had great resonance with that. We saw Bernie Sanders talk about a rigged economy, and there was enormous resonance with that. You know, it's no secret that there's really an all-time low level of confidence and trust in our basic social institutions. According to a New York Times poll, towards the end of the election, something like 82% of voters were disgusted with the conduct of the election. You know, we know that most voters...
of the election by the politicians running in the election, though, not necessarily by...
Well, I think it's a diffuse
who are
form.
Working at the
you can
polls.
Look at other polls. Oh no, it's not the poll takers, okay. Of course.
But see, I don't want to. But I'm trying to be sure that we're specific about what we're talking about here, because it's one thing. And yes, absolutely. People
specific.
Very much share your concern about how this election
and
was
not only
run
the election,
by the candidates.
You know, it's really well. It's
but,
not
but we're
only that.
We're talking about actual votes cast.
Yes,
and you're asking
but
for a recount
be clear
of those
that
votes.
That the sense of cynicism out there is not just limited to politicians. It also applies to our basic institutions, to the media, to the executive branch, to the judicial branch. Polls are, you know, there's a mountain of polls showing that people do not have confidence in our system across the board. And what we're saying now is that we have machines that have been proven to be wide open to tampering and human error, that we need to have safeguards built in. One of those safeguards is recounting the vote, and that going forward in the future, we should have automatic audits that are built in and recounts that are guaranteed. Taxpayers should not have to raise, we the voters should not have to raise millions of dollars in order to verify the vote. And what's common about all these three states is that they all use highly questionable equipment, or they all had very questionable sort of red flag results. They all had razor-thin margins. They all went the opposite way of what was expected. So they all meet these criteria. In Wisconsin, these outlawed voting machines. In Pennsylvania,
well, let me just be clear. When you say outlawed, they weren't outlawed in Wisconsin, but similar machines the state of California opted not to use.
Well, they had been using them, and they decided not to use them because the evidence that these were tamper-prone, error-prone machines was so overwhelming. And it's not
in
just
California.
No. This was evidence done in academic centers. I believe it was the University of Michigan, actually, where this research was being done.
Indeed, so, but you used the word outlawed. So they're what you're citing
they,
research
they
that does exist.
They decertified them. Yes, exactly.
In because California.
And they are in the process of doing that also in Maryland and in Virginia. So many authorities are looking at this, and the academics are looking at this and saying, we deserve better. Why should we be working with tamper-prone machines? We deserve a vote count that we can have confidence in, especially in this current climate where cynicism is running high.
Would you have been requesting or petitioning for recounts in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania if the margin had been identical but the winner had been Hillary Clinton?
It's no secret that I am not a friend of one of these campaigns over the other. And I took incredible heat throughout the course of the election because I refused to subscribe to that theory. So I have no special friendly feelings towards one candidate here or the other. In fact, when we declared that we were going into Michigan, the result was not established at that point. So we had one uncertain state, whereas there were two that that were Republican. And it happens that these three states meet the criteria of having a high probability of showing a problem. If we show no problem, that is great. But in my mind, that doesn't change the necessity for a voting system that we can have confidence in. And again, what the academics and those who watchdog this issue of voting integrity will tell you is that over and over, we see cases of massive errors, tens of thousands of votes that didn't get counted or they mistakenly got switched and attributed to one candidate rather than the other. But where have we discovered these problems? Only when there has been a recount with the paper ballots or where there have been court cases that have looked at, for example, the disenfranchisement of the communities of color in Toledo in 2004. They took the results to court, and that's where they uncovered these 90,000 votes that had basically been neglected. They didn't get counted because they didn't quite fit properly into the way that the counting machines had been programmed.
So specifically, just to walk through some of the numbers in terms of the margins in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So in Michigan, Donald Trump's margin of victory over Hillary Clinton was approximately 11,000 votes. You actually won some 50,000 votes there. Gary Johnson got 170,000. In Wisconsin, Trump's win over Clinton was almost 23,000. You got 30,000 votes there. And in Pennsylvania, Trump's margin over Clinton was some 68,000 votes. You got 48,000. Gary Johnson got 142,000 votes there. Again, mentioning Gary Johnson because he was the other not Democrat or Republican candidate. And I ask you that because over Twitter earlier today, I got a question from a listener from Ohio, actually, who calls himself Pabst Benatar, who said, knowing how the election turned out with these thin margins, would you still have run?
So let me say very specifically, if you run the numbers on the vote counts that came in on which the election was declared, and you ask, if we took out Green Party voters, would it have made a difference? Well, the reality is, exit polls show 61% of Greens would not have come out to cast a vote for either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And of those who would have come out, over a third would have actually voted for Donald Trump. So it's not like you can just say Green voters, oh, that means Democratic Party. It does not. So, in fact, the votes that would have actually translated to Hillary Clinton's advantage would not have made the difference in any state based on the vote counts that were available on Election Day. So, in fact, it's just not true that we held the margin of difference. But let me say further, there's a more important general point here. Is the solution to a compromised democracy, some would say on life support, is the solution to silence opposition voices? I don't think so, you know, because democracy depends on voices and choices and opposition. So why don't we just fix the system so that it prevents this splitting of the vote? The state of Maine decided to do that this year. They passed ranked choice voting as a voter referendum. That means when you go into the polls, you rank your choices. So if your first choice loses, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice so that there's no issue about a divided vote or having an unintended consequence with your vote. This is how we solve that issue of, you know, the threat of third parties. Do they inadvertently help the greater evil, whereas otherwise we're voting for the lesser evil? You know, the whole idea that you vote against the candidate you're most afraid of rather than voting for what your values are, is that what democracy is? Is it simply who do we hate the most? You know, we need an affirmative agenda, and we need a voting system that actually allows us to come into the voting booth, and cast a vote for what we believe in. Democracy needs a moral compass. ranked choice voting would get that moral compass back into the election process.
Well, what would you say? What would you say to the people who would like to tell you that what they believe in is not having someone like Steve Bannon, who has embraced white nationalism and has you know offered his media empire as a megaphone for it,
yes,
as the chief strategist for the next administration? And that's what we have now,
and
that
really
they believe in, that their belief was to not have that.
Of course.
And yet,
and this is a case in point, because most of Donald Trump's voters, and this was established by several polls throughout the campaign, most voters were not voting for Donald Trump. They were voting against Hillary Clinton and the political establishment. This was consistent throughout the campaign. So if they had had other choices, like Bernie Sanders, for example, would have won hands down against Donald Trump. And there were manipulations going on in that election as well. Had I been a party to that election, I would have called for a recount and for counting all of the votes, including the voters who were stripped from the voting lists in Brooklyn, as well as the hundreds of thousands of votes that did not get counted in California. So there were real irregularities there in that vote that should have been recounted and subject to scrutiny, in my opinion. But you need standing in that election. You had to have been a candidate. So I couldn't recount that one. But this is one in which I can. And let me just say, this issue of having Donald Trump in office wouldn't be the case if Bernie Sanders had been a candidate, or had there been open debates. And people have seen at that point, when there were just four candidates and Bernie wasn't an option, many people who voted for Donald Trump would not have voted for Donald Trump had they had another option with integrity. But they did not want to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Well, I mean, when you say that this issue of Donald Trump being in office would not have happened if Bernie Sanders had been the Democratic nominee, I'm not sure we can say that, because that's not what happened. In other words,
you can't second guess reality.
Well,
that's
exactly
true, but that's what the polls would have suggested.
Well, I mean,
he was winning hands down.
But we also know that there were problems with polling throughout this entire election.
As to the degree that we have evidence, that was certainly the suggestion. So I'm just making the larger point here that by silencing candidates, especially those who represent a point of view that's outside of the political establishment, as Bernie Sanders did, as my campaign did, when you silence outsiders, then you really run a risk of, you know, it doesn't help democracy to silence outsiders, put it that way.
For the record, you're speaking to someone who very much believes that that the American body politic would benefit from robust third-party participation, third, fourth, fifth parties, whatever. I do think in the long run, having two long-standing, very well-established, only two parties is not good in terms of reflecting the diversity of opinion in this country. But what I want to get back to here is not so much the what ifs of if we were other parties had a larger voice, but back to what you were saying when you were talking about a compromised democracy that could be reflected, which is one of the reasons why you're asking for these recounts. And we're just running out of time here, so I just want to get back to this for one moment. I mean, do you really believe that people should not have faith in the counts that went on in their individual states, that we should genuinely be concerned about what happens when we're in the voting booth and we put those ballots into the box?
I think there's no doubt we already are concerned. This isn't a matter of me, you know, ginning up some PR campaign out there. We basically put out a single press release and established a website where people could make contributions to create a recount. And overnight, we had millions of dollars that came in the form of small contributions from over 140,000 small donors at this point. You know, it's not like people need to be convinced or that their fears should be whipped up. Unfortunately, this is the reality that we're in today. There's widespread cynicism. A lot of people did not vote and will not vote because they have real concerns about the system, which is exactly why we should have built-in safeguards so that we can restore confidence and maintain confidence that when we go to vote, those votes will be counted and they'll be counted accurately.
So following these three recounts, if all of them actually happen, which we're not certain yet that they all will go through, Will you continue to advocate for this? Because, I mean, what you're asking for in the long run would require, like, changes at the state level in terms of election law in all 50 states.
Yes, and you may not have been around at the time, but I ran for Secretary of State here in Massachusetts in 2006. So this is not a new issue. The Green Party led the fight for a recount in 2004. So, you know, these are longstanding issues. I think these are deep concerns. They first came to public attention with the recounts.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, will you lead the effort to change state law to make, you know, automatic recounts for narrower?
Of course, as we've been fighting for ranked choice voting and to get money out of politics, we actually passed that. Remember, in Massachusetts, before the year 2000, we passed it, and the Democratic legislature, in all of their wisdom, repealed it on a voice vote after we, the people, had passed clean money politics and financing on in a referendum with a 2-to-1 margin. So this is a long overdue series of reforms, and I think counting the votes is just a first step towards many changes, a whole agenda of what needs to be fixed in our very hijacked democracy. And if people are interested, it's jill2016.com/recount. The money that we're raising can only go to the recount. This is dedicated set of funds in order to take advantage of this very timely opportunity to start fixing some of what is broken with our democracy.
Well, Dr. Jill Stein, she was the 2016 Green Party nominee for president. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great talking with you, Magna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There could be a leadership shakeup in store for congressional Democrats because tomorrow, House Democrats vote on who will be the House Minority Leader. California's Nancy Pelosi has held that job for 13 years, which included 4 years as House Speaker when the Democrats were in the majority. Now, she's being challenged by Ohio's Tim Ryan. And Ryan has picked up the endorsement of Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, who called this month's presidential election results an, quote, epic failure and another lost opportunity for the Democratic Party. Congressman Lynch joins us now on the line from Washington. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
So tell us more about why you're supporting Congressman Ryan over Nancy Pelosi.
Well, I think we need to expand our focus a bit. I think the epic failure in the most recent election is that the issues that were most, that were foremost in people's minds, I think, as far as working families, were traditional issues that the Democratic Party has championed for generations. And we lost when those issues were prominent. And we had someone like Donald Trump and the Republicans, you know, take that away from us. I think we talked very little about it in the campaign. There was a different strategy out there, but in the end, I think of late we have become a narrower focused party, and that we've forgotten our roots. That when people are going to work every single day and need our support, you know, millions of families haven't had a raise in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. The conditions were right for us to win. And so, but we did not have a forceful and meaningful argument to inspire a lot of families that, and a lot of workers who actually went for Donald Trump and went for the Republicans instead of us. So, I think we've become a narrower party, you know, of the elite.
Congressman, let me ask you. I mean, I think your view is shared by others. This is a very vital conversation going on right now within the Democratic Party. But say, we don't know how the vote's going to go tomorrow, but say Congressman Ryan does win, can he or whomever becomes or is the leader of the House Democrats do what you're saying, which is essentially recapture a lost base, in your words, that the Democrats once had, and also while also not alienating those folks who are still with the party now?
Oh, I absolutely think so. I mean, we're having a speaker, well, a leader's election. I think that what what Tim Ryan's candidacy is based on is that, you know, in young, you know, it's the difference between San Francisco and Youngstown, Ohio, and we're arguing that, you know, the economic struggles of average Americans is a unifying theme that captures people of all races and creeds, and it does not simply compartmentalize the Democratic Party. It's really one that hopefully will unify us in a way that, you know, carries a broader appeal and really gets people to think about the our collective destiny,
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, just individual issues, as you know, compelling as some of them might be.
Individual issues, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we have long been, the Democrats have been long been champions of oppressed people, and I think we talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about trending issues, but we, in this last election, we talked more about free-range chicken than we talked about American workers, you know? I think that if you're going to name individual groups that you're trying to draw in, for instance, you know, with Hillary Clinton, and I know that Mark Lilla wrote about this a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times.
He wrote about identity politics, that's
right. Yeah, he did. And he talked about it at the campaign stops when, you know, she would reach out to, you know, Latinos or you know, immigrants that were trying to become citizens, or African-American families, or the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, transgender people, and she would call them out during her stops to identify, you know, with them and their struggle, but never mentioned, you know, white workers who might be, you know, 12% unemployed in that given location in Michigan or elsewhere. And when you call out to all these groups in your campaign stops and you leave other groups out, then they come to the belief that you don't care about them.
So Congressman, let me jump in here. Forgive me, because I think what you've hit on is one of the core areas of self-examination that the Democratic Party is absolutely going through right now. Because you're right, that op-ed in the New York Times got a lot of attention. Essentially, he was just saying, like, the party has focused too much on, you know, in his words, quote-unquote, identity politics for marginalized groups, and not enough on what you were talking about. But the flip side to that, and I got to ask you this, is hasn't the Republican Party been practicing a form of white identity politics for generations now? And we just saw basically the height of that in this past election, that is exactly what they were doing, but for, you know, white working class workers. It was the same thing, identity politics for them.
But we left the perfect opportunity for them to grab the independents and the working class people that have been our base and should have been with us. They, you know, they've got their shtick, and it has never been about fairness for working people, and an opportunity for you know, people that are trying to achieve the American dream. They've been, you know, the more elitist party, you know, in terms of growth in this country, and we've always, and that's my point. My point is that we let them take away that group that has been with us forever, and that really is our traditional base, by never talking about them. We've got to convince them that we do care about them, and that we're in their corner. And we didn't do much of that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't. There was a you know, a conscious decision to work on some other issues and tie Republicans to Trump. And, you know, talk about the lack of experience and all that, which was factually correct, but it didn't really inspire people. And we, you know, it was a change election, and we were pounding away at how much better experienced and what a better resume, and how someone was, you know, Hillary was much better qualified. But this was a change election, and we got our head handed to us in the election. And
right,
you know, so what I think Tim Ryan from Youngstown, Ohio brings is a perspective that I think resonates with a lot of working people that are struggling of all colors, of
right.
all creeds, you know, and I think it's a unifying theme. A lot of America hasn't had a raise in a very, very long time, and those people should be with us. Those are issues that we've been talking about for a long time. We're talking about raising the minimum wage. We're talking about preserving, you know, Davis-Bacon so that, you know, you can't undermine the wages of workers in a given region by bringing in workers from another region. We're the ones that are talking about, fair labor standards and trying to, lift workers and help them in these difficult times.
Well, Congressman, I'm afraid I'm going to have to wrap it up with you there because I know we've got to let you go. But Congressman Stephen Lynch, he represents the 8th District of Massachusetts, speaking with us today from Washington, where tomorrow House Democrats will be voting on Democratic leadership there. And Congressman Lynch has thrown his support behind Ohio's Tom Ryan. Congressman, thank you.
Tim Ryan.
Tim Ryan, my fault.
There's a couple of Ryans running, so I don't want to get mixed up.
Tim Ryan, thanks so much for the correction there, Congressman. Thanks again.
Thank you, Magna. Bye-bye now.
All right. Well, let's turn now and talk about taxes at the state level, specifically a soda tax, because this year in Philadelphia, the Chicago area, and a bunch of other cities in this month's election, taxes on sugary drinks have become law. So Massachusetts, could it be next? With us to tell us more is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hi there, Meghna. And yes, it's possible. It's a big question mark. Could it be here next?
Could soda taxes be here next? Okay. So question mark taken. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing that in these big urban areas around the country, San Francisco, mm-hmm. Oakland, mm-hmm. Boulder, passing these soda taxes. Mm-hmm. So first of all, a specific question. You know, I like details and data. What kind of drinks are we talking about here? And what's the range of taxes?
Okay, so these taxes generally focus on what's known in the lingo as SSBs, or sugar-sweetened beverages. They include soft drinks, sweetened iced tea, some fruit drinks. I don't know if Frappuccinos are in there. Personally, maybe they should be. But basically, we're talking about liquid sugar. And the tax is generally at least a penny an ounce. So for a typical, say, 12-ounce can of soda, obviously that'd tack on 12 more cents to the maybe dollar you pay in a vending machine or less at a store.
Okay, so Massachusetts has tried this before, to no avail. Mm-hmm. But the idea of a soda tax is coming up again?
Yes, it will. So Representative Kay Conn of Newton has sponsored the Massachusetts soda tax bill repeatedly in past years. And she says that in the legislative session that's coming up this January, she'll do it again. And here's an interesting new twist, that the state ballot measure that legalized recreational marijuana includes a tax on weed. And she says maybe that could play into greater public acceptance of a soda tax.
I'm hopeful that we can now move forward, as we will be with the marijuana, that we'll be able to think about doing the same thing for sugar.
Okay. Well, Massachusetts likes to lead, or likes to think that it leads on things like this, especially regarding health. But mm-hmm. it seems on this, the soda taxes in all those other cities is actually what's providing the momentum here?
Could be, yes. And there also seems to be a convergence of factors in favor of a soda tax. Some cities have passed them largely as a way to gain more money for like police or education. And also there's definitely been accumulating evidence from obesity researchers, including here at Harvard, of course, that soda contributes particularly powerfully to obesity. I spoke with Dr. Caroline Apovian, who's the director of the Center for Nutrition and Weight Management at Boston Medical Center.
Studies consistently show that, especially in children and adolescents, the intake of one can of sugar-sweetened beverages a day can increase the risk of overweight and obesity in children and adolescents.
So even just one can. And Meghna, what I find most interesting is that she and other obesity experts say that this sugar in liquid form, like soda, is particularly pernicious because somehow your brain doesn't register those calories. Like normally it keeps track of your calories and it adjusts your appetite, but it's sort of like these are invisible calories. So you eat just as much as you would have without the soda.
Okay. Carrie, of course, you are our health editor and health reporter.
Yes.
So naturally, naturally your take on you look at the public health point of view.
Tend to, yes.
But I want to talk about economics here because, I mean, nobody likes, or few people like, new taxes on anything.
True. And that has been the central issue that has defeated soda tax proposals in the past here, the whole no new taxes thing. And remember, in 2010, Massachusetts voters approved a ballot measure that repealed the sales tax on alcohol. So we do not like to pay taxes on consuming stuff we like, right?
Well, absolutely. But then there's also this issue about who is more likely to consume these drinks. And I think there have been studies that show low-income folks, especially low-income people of color, mm-hmm. May be disproportionately consuming some of these drinks. And so therefore, let's be honest, are they more likely to face the economic burden of a soda tax?
Right. So is this a regressive tax?
Does nanny state tax.
Nanny state. Yes. And so nanny state tax, you know, there are also people saying, don't tell me what I can and cannot drink. But, you know, here's the interesting question. What if this tax does affect lower income residents disproportionately? But what if it also would help them disproportionately to buy less soda because they have more obesity? So I spoke with Keith Mahoney of the Boston Foundation. They've been a big backer of the Massachusetts pushes for a soda tax. And he says, yeah, it does affect people with lower incomes more, but they are the groups with more obesity.
If you look at Massachusetts adults with diabetes by annual income, those earning $75,000 a year or more have rates at about under 4%. And those earning less than $15,000 have rates at close to 19%.
So much more diabetes among poorer people. And research in Mexico, which passed a soda tax a couple of years ago, found that the higher prices did particularly cut the consumption among the lower income people.
Okay. I mean, I'm shaking my head here because I still possess a little bit of skepticism about the patronizing nature of some nudge economics.
It is.
That's a discussion for another day.
Okay.
But what about its effectiveness, the soda tax effectiveness at getting to those underlying health issues and health problems we were talking about earlier?
Of like obesity and
yes.
diabetes, right? And the answer is it's just too early to tell. Although one recent Harvard study suggested that a 1 cent an ounce soda tax could cut diabetes by about 4%. But that's just a computer modeling. And in general, you know, backers of these measures say they're not going to be a great big panacea for the obesity epidemic, but they are a step. And maybe one of the best things that a proposal for a soda tax can do is just like help get the word out more that soda can pose health risks.
Okay, Carrie, before I let you go, one more quick thing here, because mm-hmm. you mentioned that Mexico passed a soda tax nationwide, right? But in right. the United States, the examples we were talking about earlier were cities, whereas here, Kay Khan wants to get it done at the state level.
Right. And but I should say, Keith Mahoney of the Boston Foundation tells me that there are other states that just don't exempt soda from sales tax as we do, including, by the way, Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi. So, yes, they have high obesity rates overall. But if you think taxing soda is a good thing, we in Massachusetts are behind Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi on this.
Take that, Massachusetts.
Right. You could do better. And Meghna, here's my favorite part of the whole debate. That's to come probably on the soda tax. Is soda food? Like, if something has really no nutritional value at all, it's pretty much just sugar and water. Is it food?
You're asking me this question.
I'm
going to just recuse myself from having to answer because I am not the expert. I'm a mere host.
All right, then, because I can tell you that Dr. Apovian told me it is not food. It's basically poison, but I'm still wrapping my head around that.
Okay, that's the fee from a public health person.
Yep.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health Blog, talking to us on the proposal, a soon-to-come proposal for a statewide soda tax in Massachusetts. Thank you, Carrie, as always.
You're welcome, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A report out today from the Boston Foundation says the greater Boston economy is booming, but the rising cost of living means that now more than 16% of families are living in poverty. According to the annual Greater Boston Housing Report Card, income inequality in the region remains among the highest of all metro areas in the United States. Twice the proportion of people in Greater Boston make over $150,000 than in the nation. Now, the region's rents also reached an all-time high this year at over $2,100 per month. That's 48% higher than in the year 2000. So all of this does sound more than a little bleak, but it doesn't have to be, because there doesn't necessarily have to be a trade-off between a successful economy and an affordable housing market. We just have to find the solution. And joining us with some of those possible solutions is Barry Bluestone. He's a co-author of the Greater Boston Housing Report Card and a founding director at Northeastern University's Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. Barry Bluestone, it's great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
So, Barry, you were on Morning Edition this morning.
Yeah.
And also, all the headlines for the Greater Boston Housing Report Card actually began with the fact that new housing permits have dropped. And I want to acknowledge that that was what caught a lot of people's attention. Can you just give us the, for folks who may not have heard you this morning,
right,
give us that.
Well, we've been following housing permits, which, of course, is the second stage in getting something built, apply, permit, build. And we found for the first time in 5 years a reduction in the number of permits quite sharply, particularly in Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville. We don't know if this is just a temporary pause. It could be a longer run trend, which would mean we'll never come close to meeting the housing goals we have to house another 160,000 households by the year 2030. So what we're looking at now is asking the question, why? The one answer is, we are at the end of a boom in luxury housing.
We've done a great job at building those $3,000 a month apartments.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, $3,000 a month is $36,000 a year in rent. And there aren't a lot of people who can spend $36,000. So the thing that we've been asking then is, how can we get developers who know how to build luxury housing to think about building housing for working people, for middle class? And we think we've come up with some ideas.
Okay, so explain to me why, before we get into those ideas, why this is more important than ever. I mean, you've been on the show frequently talking about the need for middle class and affordable housing, but in the Greater Boston Housing Report Card, the one that just came out, this latest one, I mean, we have this astonishing number about the poverty rate in,
right,
Greater Boston.
Well, what we did is that I've been following the poverty discussion since 1964, when Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty, and somebody said, how will you know if you're winning? And so they had to figure out a poverty threshold. And so they did a poverty threshold in 1964, and each year they've just increased it by the consumer price index, by inflation. They've never adjusted it for the cost of living differences, mm-hmm, across the country. And it turns out the cost of living in Greater Boston is about 38% higher than the nation. So I adjusted the poverty rate and found out, instead of having a poverty rate below the national level, about 11%, our poverty rate for families is about 16%, and for all households, including, you know, a single individual or two people living together, it's almost one quarter of our population in Greater Boston is under the poverty, adjusted poverty threshold.
One quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Is that number likely to grow unless we get a handle on the housing crisis?
Absolutely, because while the average cost of living in Greater Boston is 38% higher than the rest of the country, it's driven by a 75% price differential on housing. Mm. So if we can't solve the housing problem, that means we're going to have an increasing number of people who not only can't afford housing, they can't afford, you know, to live here.
Yeah.
And I think there are two problems. One, it's an ethical problem. People should be able to live here if they want to. But number two, we're also going to be facing a terrible shortage of labor as older people like myself, I'm going to be 72 next month, are going to retire. How do we keep young people here if they can't find housing they can afford?
Hmm.
So far, we've been successful, but if we continue to see rents going through the roof, it's going to be hard for people to live here, and that's going to make it very difficult for businesses to hire.
So the Greater Boston housing cost burden you've found, and that's defined as paying more than 30% of income on rent, has increased to 50% of folks between 2010 and 2014. And then you also found that in Boston, for example, the number of permits issued for affordable units has gone down, just 18% of all permits between 2011 and 2016, down from the 26% that it was 6 years before that.
Right.
So that's some more context there. Let's get to those solutions, given,
okay,
that these are the trends. What are we going to do?
Yeah. So developers know how to build luxury housing. In fact, to some extent, it's easy. because people will pay exorbitant amounts of money, either people who live here now or an increasing number of people who from Russia, China, Norway, who are investing in housing here as a bank vault. So a lot of the housing that's been built is, well, it's housing, but since nobody's living in it, I'm not sure we should call it housing.
Right.
What they haven't figured out, and I can understand why they can't, is how do you build housing for everybody else? We know how to build some housing for the very poor because there's subsidies, but everything in between, working families, the police officer, the firefighter, the teacher, the young graduate student who's just starting out, they don't know how to do it because the cost of housing here, cost of land, cost of construction materials, cost of construction labor,
permitting.
The soft cost, the permitting. We last year found out that to build a triple-decker, a little frame triple-decker, two bedrooms and one bath on each floor, would now cost $1.1 million to build.
Just to build it.
To build it. So to build housing that is appropriate for families, like say a family of four, like your family, it's almost impossible. So what we've been saying is, okay, in 1870 to 1920, we had 500,000 new immigrants just in Boston, 500,000. We housed them all in a new kind of housing, the triple-decker. After World War II, we had all the returning GIs. They wanted to move to the suburbs. We figured out how to do that with suburban housing. Now we have a demographic revolution in Greater Boston, which is overwhelmingly made up of young people and seniors. And the old-fashioned single-family home isn't going to work for them.
Yeah.
So now how can we build housing that's so exciting for them that they move out of the triple-decker and make room
for the,
families?
So I'm hearing micro-units and villages on the horizon.
Right. It's not just micro-units, but we now have a lot of people, Tamara Roy at the Boston Society of Architects and others who are thinking about micro-units, building a manufacturing facility here where we'd have panelized units. But then for whom? And the argument is, young people before they start their families. So I'm thrilled to say that all of the conservatory presidents here, from the Boston Conservatory, the Berkeley Conservatory, the New England Conservatory, Mass College of Art, the Boston Society of Architects, Emerson College, have gotten together now on the direction of Richard Ortner, the president of the Boston Conservatory, to build an artist village that would house up to 600 young artists who are graduate students or alums who are now trying to be musicians or actresses or actors. Scott Bailey, who's the executive director of Mass Challenge, has all these great people, wants to build a starter village. Again, housing for that demographic. And so what we think we have to do is bring more people to the table. We've got to get university presidents. We've got to get hospital administrators where they have all of these interns and residents who need housing.
Barry, can I just jump in here? Because you know I'm a huge fan of yours, and I really actually very much appreciate the research that goes into the annual housing report. But don't take this the wrong way. Sometimes I feel like when I hear about these, you know, these villages and these new ideas, et cetera, it feels very aspirational to me.
Right.
Like, could we get these new kind of housings online in time to really take the edge off this crisis that we're in?
Right. That's why I'm excited today, and you can hear it in my voice, because 2 years ago, no one was talking about this. And now we've had a meeting with all of the conservatory presidents. I think some of the other university presidents are starting to talk about it. And when we can get the new people involved with housing who've never been involved before, we have a chance of getting the governor, the mayor, developers, construction firms, all working together to solve this problem.
And would this help address those underlying issues that you were talking about that led to the $1.1 million triple-decker, the cost of the land, the cost of the labor, the permitting? I mean, those things, I'm not hearing those being changed.
We have to work on all of those. So we have to have zoning reform. We passed zoning reform through the Senate, Mass Senate. We got to get it through the House. We've got to find ways of reducing the other soft costs, all the regulatory red tape. We've got to find a way of reducing the cost of construction, and that's why this manufacturing facility could work. Build more that way. We also have to figure out if there's land that's available, let's say, from the city-owned land or state-owned land or MBTA-owned land at Forest Hills that would be able to reduce the cost of the land. So we're trying to bring together all the parties that control land, that control zoning and other regulations, that control construction costs, and say, okay, Folks, it's time we all work together to solve this problem.
Interesting. One last thing. Sheila Dillon at the City of Boston, head of housing there, she actually in the Globe was talking about a fine line that the city has to walk in terms of being a place where developers want to be because they would still get a return on their investment versus what you're talking about, which is also keeping rents in check. I mean, do you think the city's positioned to do that? Just got a couple seconds.
I think we can if we can get everybody working together on this problem.
Well, Barry Bluestone is a founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern University. He's also co-author of the new Boston Housing Report Card. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Barry, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.